post 9/11. Is that right?
Of course. You know, I used to work with the PLO when it was deemed a terrorist group. Oftentimes these groups, which are liberation movements in the eyes of some and terrorist movements in the eyes of others, become your chief negotiating partners, as Arafat did and as, of course, Nelson Mandela did. So, you know, I find the whole rise of the security and surveillance state, the whole sort of stripping away of our civil liberties, which has been more egregious under the Obama administration than it was under the Bush administration, quite frightening. Because when you give government this kind of power, certainly when government feels threatened or when there is any kind of civil unrest, they'll use it. I mean, history has shown that.
With the continuing incarceration of many suspected terrorists in Guantanamo and elsewhere under indefinite detention, along with the revelations from Edward Snowden about the NSA's massive dragnet surveillance programs and the erosion of civil liberties since 9/11, do you believe the American people are sufficiently aware of the dangers to our civil liberties now? And what course of action do you recommend for concerned citizens to take action to restore and protect their constitutional rights?
I don't think people are sufficiently aware. We have, especially on the electronic media, a kind of complete collapse of real journalism. You have cable shows like Fox, which essentially become mouthpieces of the right wing. MSNBC is a mouthpiece of the Democratic Party. But you didn't hear about it on MSNBC because it would have reflected poorly on Obama. You didn't hear about it on Fox because this has bipartisan support. But that was a window into how impoverished our journalism has become, that a case of this importance and this magnitude was not covered at all. I think since the Snowden revelations, it's been very hard for the government to mask the wholesale surveillance that they are carrying out of every American citizen and the storing of all of our personal information in perpetuity. And yet at the same time, I have yet to see any serious calls for reform, either by the administration or by congressional leaders, and that I find quite worrying, because if we don't wrest back our privacy, then we cannot talk about a free press, we cannot talk about the right to dissent, and I think it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that we cannot even talk anymore about liberty.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges. Find more news and analysis on indefinite detention on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Shortly after MCHM, a chemical used in coal processing, spilled into the water supply of 300,000 West Virginians on January 9th, Andrew Welton, an assistant professor of civil engineering at South Alabama University, drove with a graduate student 900 miles to Charleston to advise residents on how to flush their water systems in order to minimize contact with the chemical. He initially went to assist as a volunteer, but because of his early efforts, he and a colleague were awarded a $750,000 grant by West Virginia to lead the state's testing assessment project. Professor Welton put together a global team of experts to study various aspects of the disaster. Most people affected by the toxic contamination were still not using tap water for drinking, though many were using it for other purposes in the weeks and months after the Do Not Use order was lifted, several days after the initial spill. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who spent several days in and around Charleston in early March reporting on the disaster, spoke with Professor Welton about his study, which he called historic. Here he talks about the problems that resulted from a lack of scientific information that led both the state and the water utility to declare the chemical non-detectable at a certain level, although Welton and his team were able to detect MCHM at far lower levels as they conducted studies of the water quality in 80 homes spread throughout the affected area.
We shipped the contaminant that was spilled into the river. We were able to get the actual chemical that was sequestered after it was spilled, or residual in the tank, and we shipped that across the country to California to begin immediate odor testing of it to determine at what level you can smell it in water. We shipped it to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and Monrovia, California, where they started characterizing it. The WDTAP team has started looking at the byproducts of how the different drinking water system chemicals interact with these chemicals that were spilled, because one of the concerns that we had up front was that we knew everybody was looking for crude MCHM, which is a mixture of at least eight compounds, but many of the efforts had been focused on what's called 4-MCHM, which is one of those eight compounds. we know from basic environmental chemistry and engineering that chemicals transform sometimes in water treatment plants into unintended byproducts. That actually has never been talked about by state officials or federal officials, and that is something that the scientific community has been asking for all along. So there's many, many people that have been sending me emails asking, why hasn't the government considered looking at other compounds that were produced? And we have done that.
So, Andrew Weldon, when you and your team report your findings, will you be able to say whether or not the water is safe? That's what everyone was waiting for when I was down there 2 weeks ago. They were waiting for the results of the tests.
What you're referring to is just a basic understanding that everybody has, including us. What are the chemical levels in the water, and are those acceptable in terms of will they make me acutely sick or will they have chronic effects to not simply me, but my children, my friend's baby, my elderly grandmother? I mean, these are the questions that people are asking, and they have every right to do so because I would be asking the same thing. The toxicology panel that the WVTAP program is convening will examine the available data to determine if the levels that the state of West Virginia have instituted, the 10 part per billion or 10 ppb level for MCHM, are protective of public health. Next, they'll also look at the CDC's level of 1,000 part per billion to see if that level was protective of public health. And I expect, I can't speak for the panel, but I expect that they will make recommendations in terms of what other information should have been available to make certain determinations. Now, one of the major points that a lot of critics, including myself, make was that at the very beginning, a lot of the declarations that the water was safe to drink or that a certain level of chemical is acceptable weren't really backed up with enough public scrutiny in terms of availability of knowledge and availability of data and outside vetting. And so what we are doing is we are coming in through the expert panel and actually trying to determine if what happened in terms of what levels cause acute or chronic health effects are valid. What's important to recognize here, and I know that throughout this incident, everybody's been talking about part per billion or ppb and ppm. The fact of the matter is the screening level that West Virginia set for its population was 10 part per billion. And they did this because at the time, I do know that analytical laboratories could only get to 10 part per billion. So they could only conclusively say that a chemical was present above 10 part per billion. The odor results that Dr. Mark Weyer has come out with basically demonstrate that at very, very low level, you can still smell some type of odor in that water with crude MCHM in it, even if the water is determined safe to drink at 10 part per billion.
Does that mean it really isn't safe, or people don't know?
That's a great question. The odor is one component of this, mainly because throughout the incident, the state, as well as the utility, were declaring the chemical was not present. The chemical for MCHM was not present at a certain level. So they would say, it's non-detect at 10 part per billion. And then the public would say, but my water smells like licorice. And the response was, but it's non-detect at 10 part per billion. Or more recently, non-detect at 3 part per billion. And somebody will say, but my water smells like licorice. Well, Dr. McGuire's work demonstrates that, first of all, there's a messaging issue here, that just because you can't detect something doesn't mean it's not there and it's not causing problems, which then raises the concern by homeowners and somebody, me included, that what is causing the odor and what concentration is it?
That was Andrew Welton, an assistant professor of civil engineering at South Alabama University, who pulled a team together to investigate the toxic chemical spill into the water supply of 300,000 West Virginians. Find more information on the West Virginia chemical spill and lax regulation on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
And stay tuned now for Locus Focus. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from xray.fm. The people at xray.fm would like to thank KABU for 45 years of work in the service of better community radio for Portland and the world. xray.fm is proud to support the pioneering work of KABU and wouldn't be here without it.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This May, voters in Jackson County in Southern Oregon will be voting on the Family Farms Measure, a ballot measure that would ban genetically engineered crops from being grown in the county. If it passes, Jackson County will join three California counties, Mendocino, Santa Cruz, and Marin, where GMO bans are already in place. But Jackson County will be the only county in Oregon that can vote on this issue, since the Oregon legislature passed a preemptive law last summer prohibiting any other local anti-GMO ordinances. This morning, we'll talk with Elise Higley, campaign director for the Family Farms Measure, about the growing community of organic farmers in Southern Oregon who are banding together to stop the proliferation of genetically modified crops. Elise, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think a lot of people up here in the northern part of Oregon are very unaware of why GMO crops are even an issue in Southern Oregon. We've heard some up here about a lot of the battles in the Willamette Valley around GMO sugar beets and GMO canola. But what's going on in Southern Oregon that has prompted you to actually try to ban it via ballot measure?
Well, I mean, I think like so many areas in Oregon, through the nation and, you know, throughout the world, as farmers, we're really concerned about the market value of our products. I mean, we know that in general, the market, and especially the world market, is just not tolerating genetically engineered crops. And so it really puts us at a disadvantage and, you know, a loss of millions you've seen in other parts of the state, you know, with the wheat crisis, obviously, with that happening, $7.5 million loss. And then on top of it, we are a big seed growing industry here in Jackson County. So that is, you know, that's kind of how we discovered that one of the biggest, you know, chemical companies in the world was having these little test plots and breeding their sugar beet seeds. And that's really what we're patched with here in the Jackson County.
So there's actually a link between what's going on in Jackson County with sugar beets and what's going on a wider scale in the Willamette Valley, where
right, we're being used as their incubator for their GE sugar beet seeds. So that's why you know, they go out of our economy and they make millions someplace else, you know, because they're not able to grow them in their own country. And
what is their own country? Who is this company and what is their country?
So Syngenta is the company who's growing the sugar beets.
And where they
based? Swiss owned.
As are several other major chemical companies, it seems.
Right. So they're not able to grow them in their own country, on their own land, and so they're coming here and using our land and then making the local farmers market unsellable, and then also putting us at legal risk because of patent infringement.
Well, we'll get to that in a little while. I want to talk a little bit about the geography of your region for people who aren't familiar with Jackson County. When we were talking on the phone last night, you were talking about the valley, but there's actually a whole network of valleys. Is that correct? And it's you don't have a wide valley like we have
correct.
Here with the Willamette Valley. So what kind of added issues does the geography down in your area play in terms of the difficulty of having the coexistence of GMO and non-GMO crops?
Right. So our valley is, you know, very narrow and windy, and it has all these little isolated pockets, and that's what makes it so wonderful for seed breeding. But it also means that if there's one seed breeder there and they're growing genetically engineered seed, then they are at risk of contaminating all the other farms. And that's currently what is happening with Syngenta growing their sugar beets.
So what seeds are being grown in Jackson County before Syngenta moved in? What was the traditional basis of farming?
We have lots of seed growers in the valley, actually. And we are not on the land that we're talking about, especially on some of the seed farms. They're not big farms. They're small, little plots of land, and they're clean land because this area in particular is in the seed farms. We need the cleanest land possible to have the purest seed. And so it wasn't traditionally big agricultural land. It was dairy farms, and that's why we still are able to have this clean land here. And we feel like it's our responsibility to preserve this land and keep it clean.
Now, unlike Josephine County, which is pretty mountainous, I guess you actually have really good soil. This is like the Rogue River Valley and then some of the smaller rivers like Applegate?
Yeah, and part of Josephine County has wonderful soil as well, and they're working to preserve their right to farm how they want to as well.
And this as an aside, because this kind of goes back to the debates that were going on last summer in the state legislature when they actually revived what some people are calling the Monsanto Protection Act, though I think that's kind of a narrow term for what they did, which was to ban ordinances like the one, or ban ballot measures like the one that you were going to be voting on next month in your county. But there was concern that we can't have a patchwork solution. We can't have patchwork bans of GMOs in some places and not in others. And so that's a concern. If you do pass your ballot measure to ban GMOs in Jackson County, how does that affect, let's say, the part of the Applegate Valley that's in Josephine County?
Well, I think that the real drive in getting so many people involved in this ballot measure is just the exact fear that our opposing side has, in their pleas for help and funding. They're saying, if this passes in Jackson County, this is going to spread throughout the state, possibly throughout the nation, and oh my, what could happen? So they see it as a real potential loss for them, and we see it as a real